Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee to order, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2996 and 2997. Janet, can you give us a rundown on the bills?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2996 would change the dollar threshold for public works projects that require contractors to pay the prevailing wage rate. There is a blank in the bill for the new what the new threshold would be, and it does require the threshold to be adjusted each year for inflation based on the consumer price index, a specific consumer price index. There is an emergency clause on the bill as well. Mr. Chair, the current threshold is $25,000. That's the project threshold that triggers the requirement for payment of prevailing wage, state prevailing wage. The threshold has been $25,000 since 1995, when it was raised from $10,000. And, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2997 would exempt public improvement projects from competitive bid requirements and from prevailing wage rate requirements if a community group or nonprofit organization contributes at least half the value of the project. And it would require the contracting agency to include the value of volunteer labor in determining the total value of the project. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Representative Hannah and Richard Myers, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. With me also is my Chief of Staff, Bob Avery.
Morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
All right. Well, good morning, Chairman Brown, members. Thank you for hearing us here this morning. I am State Representative Bruce Hanna. I represent House District 7, which is Eastern Lane and Eastern Douglas counties, the ruralmost parts of both of those. Geographically, House District 7 is the fifth largest in the state of Oregon, and the largest town I represent is Cottage Grove at just over 9,000 people. During my race for state representative and during the time that I was out meeting the folks around House District 7, one of my commitments was to help them build Oregon from the community up, to do whatever I could to help make those communities a better place to live. In meetings around the district, many of the small towns expressed frustration in doing that, building their communities. They talked about the regulations on public contracting for relatively small public projects as being an impediment to improving their towns. Specifically, the Little Davis Bacon or Bureau of Labor and Industries, BOLI, contracting provisions and how they impact small communities and the contracts they let. Currently, any contract that uses public monies in excess of $25,000 is subject to prevailing wage and other certification provisions within BOLI. That threshold has not been changed since 1995. Our bill, as originally submitted, would increase the threshold to $125,000, and it would have indexed that threshold on an annual basis. When we first turned the bill in, we specifically left the dollar amount out in an attempt to build consensus as to what it should be. Toward that end, we have met with various stakeholders to discuss the bill and this particular provision of it. We've worked towards consensus with these stakeholders, most of whom agree that it is time for a change. The specifics of that change are the question before this committee. We've considered a number of issues within those changes. Indexing the original threshold of $5,000 from its inception in 1959 for construction cost price index would come to just under $100,000. A review of the contract shows the number of contracts in various levels as provided by BOLI, and you'll see some of that in our written testimony. Increasing the threshold to $100,000 would eliminate 42.5% of the number of contracts, yet only affect 3.4% of the total contract dollar amount, and would result in substantial reduction in administrative overhead. Increasing the threshold to $125,000 would eliminate 48.7% of the number of contracts, yet only affect 4.4% of the total contract dollar amount. Increasing the threshold to $250,000 would eliminate 65.7% of the number of contracts, yet only affect 8.9% of the total dollar amount. $125,000 corresponds with other provisions in the current law. This is the threshold for projects that contracting agencies report to BOLI when they do the work with their own staff. And this is part of ORS 279023. Substantial increases in the threshold will dramatically reduce the administrative overhead and allow many smaller emerging contractors to compete for these small contracts while still protecting the trades for the majority of the construction dollars spent on public works projects. Provisions for indexing were included in the original bill, avoid the need for future legislation. And then we talk about what are other states doing. And a review of the U.S. Department of Labor websites indicate state prevailing wage law thresholds vary dramatically from none at all to $500,000. 18 states have no state prevailing wage laws and have repealed them, many recently. Of the 32 remaining states, approximately one-third have thresholds in the range we are considering or higher. As indicated earlier, we have met with many of the stakeholders. There is consensus that it's time for a change, as the current threshold of $25,000, again, has not been changed since 1995. The amount of change is really the discussion point. At this time, we are recommending the -2 amendment. This will increase the threshold to $125,000. It will eliminate the indexing provision, as when we met with the stakeholders, many said the indexing was a very difficult and onerous task to keep up with on an annual basis. This will put the threshold near where it would be had it been indexed from the beginning of the act and with some consideration for the future. It will correspond to other provisions of the law and therefore simplify the process by keeping thresholds at the same level. Eliminating the indexing provision makes the law easier to work with. While the index would reduce the need for future legislation, we've heard from the many stakeholders that an index could potentially create confusion. The threshold would always be changing and would have to be calculated specifically for each project. In closing, we heard from our small towns asking for relief from the current BOLI provisions on small contracts. They described a number of small projects in their communities that they would like to do. Often they have the money to do, but once the BOLI provisions kick in, they feel constrained from actually doing those projects. Increasing the threshold will reduce the administrative overhead on small projects. Increasing the threshold will enable contracting agencies, especially those in the more rural portions of the state, to have a broader choice of the contractors for their small contract work. Let's make it easier for our small communities to continue improving. Let's unite their hands on these small projects so that they can do what they need to do. And let's see what we can do to help them keep contracting dollars within their community. Let's help them build Oregon from the community up. I would urge your support of the passage of HB 2996 with the -2 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Richard, why don't you go ahead and give your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Richard Myers, the city manager for the city of Cottage Grove, the All-America City in Oregon for 2004. I'm here to express the City of Cottage Grove's support for House Bill 2996 and the -2 amendments. This bill will have a significant impact on our community. When I started in local government about 15 years ago, a $25,000 amount was a pretty large project for a small community. Now it's sad to say that $25,000 doesn't buy you much in the way of public works projects. You used used to be able to do 2 to 3 blocks in an overlay project for public works with $25,000 or close to that amount. Now you can barely do one. The projects that are now falling under the prevailing wage rules are small, and they are small projects. Many of the projects are projects that our small contractors could do locally. Contractors like Concrete Bob, he's actually one of our contractors in Cottage Grove, and Bradley Grover could do some of our small concrete work or our handicap ramps on an intersection. Yet, almost 2 handicap ramps will trigger the Prevailing Wage Act. So because of that, those projects have moved into that larger range. Raising the prevailing wage rate threshold to $125,000 will increase the number of bids that we'll be able to receive on these projects. A number of those small contractors just don't have the ability or the accounting sense or even the bonding necessary to fulfill the prevailing wage requirements. And it'll reduce the accounting and paperwork that the city will have to do, as well as the contractors. And as Representative Hanna has already said, it will only reduce the amount of dollars amount for total projects in the state by about 4.8%, while reducing the number of projects by 48%. So it kind of shows you that the number of projects that have moved into the prevailing wage rate threshold is quite large. It's actually been growing over the years, and it will continue to grow as projects are smaller and smaller and hit that threshold faster. The new threshold also makes sense, as Representative Hanna has explained, with the using the construction cost index from the Engineering News Record, that it would bring it up close to the $100,000 amount if you indexed it from 1959. To make what this would do real for you, we recently went out for quotes on a project in the community. The quotes came back in at $27,000 from one of the contractors. We asked the contractor, okay, you're over the $25,000 limit. Did you give us a quote at the prevailing wage rate? The contractor was silent and said, we'll get back to you on that. About 2 days later, they called up, and the new quote was $24,700. The costs of doing a prevailing wage project associated with the paperwork and accounting requirements was worth it for that firm to knock the price down to $24,700. That's a significant impact, I think, to the community, that there's a lot of bidders out there that are not taking an opportunity to work on small prevailing wage projects. The city also had the opportunity just recently to amend our own purchasing ordinance. Our original purchasing ordinance had a limit at $25,000 requiring sealed bids. We went out for bids on a project, and we got one bid from an out-of-city firm. And the city council members were wondering why we got just one bid. And they went and visited with some of the contractors locally. They found out that the local people didn't want to go through the paperwork of a sealed bid process for a $25,000 project. So we've raised our bid limit up to $75,000 for sealed bids. And along the same lines, this paperwork for prevailing wage is something that is going to limit or restrict the number of bidders. And those are the examples that are out there right now. The other purpose for being at $125,000 is there are a lot of different dollar amounts out there in state legislation or in our local ordinances that cities have to follow. We've got the QBS that's at $400,000. We've got the force accounts under 379C305 that tell us that if we bid something or have a project that's over $125,000, we have to report to the Bureau of Labor and Industries and review whether or not we will do the project locally with our own forces or if we're going to contract that. By moving the threshold for prevailing wage to the same amount as the force account requirement already in state statute, it makes sense and is consistent with things that are already happening for local entities. So on those basis, the City of Cottage Grove and the community of Cottage Grove support the legislation in 2996 with the -2 amendments.
Thank you, Richard. Any questions? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, when you did the bid for 20-some thousand, you went back to almost 25,000. What would it have been with the prevailing wage? Did you ever get a number on that?
We never did get a number on that.
Because I imagine you run up against a threshold with your CDBG funding. you get from the federal government, do you not?
This wouldn't have been a CDBG project, so it wouldn't have run up against the federal threshold, but it would have increased it a little bit. Probably another $1,000 or $2,000, I would imagine. A major portion of that project was actual equipment or a hardware that they were installing.
Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that one of the reasons that prevailing wage laws or prevailing wage rates sort of are an impediment for small contractors being the paperwork involved, basically, that your small contractors can't do the paperwork that's involved to do a prevailing wage job. I mean, for me, that's really a kind of a hard thing to grasp, because there's usually paperwork, whether it's just, you know, contracts with just about any job. Is there any other reason why, for example, Concrete Bob wouldn't be able to do a small prevailing wage job?
Chairman Brown and Representative Holby, the possible other issues would be, number one, they've got to file their certified payroll report. Possibly, and this would be the issue, I believe, is that they would also have difficulty with some of the bonding requirements or other requirements associated with certifying how they are doing their payroll. Most of these are sole proprietor firms. I mean, they don't have any employees. They may have one employee that comes on temporarily with larger projects that they do. But they're local contractors. They're licensed. They're working. They don't have an accounting office. They do it at night at home, or their wife does it, or something like that. And so they just don't have the resources to do some of that paperwork.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate what you're saying. Having worked for some small contractors before, I do have a concern that these small projects really are, you know, one of the things that keeps small companies going, and the fact that they pay, you know, good wages is also a benefit to those workers in our community. Making living wages and having health care so they don't have to rely on the health plan and all that. But, you know, I do have a concern that, you know, looking over the numbers, is the amount of projects that raising this threshold takes away, that, you know, we're taking a lot of contracts away from small contractors who pay good wages. And, you know, I have a little concern about that project count. You know, notwithstanding the amount of dollars that you talked about and the paperwork it might save the community or the cities. But do you have any records or any sort of documentation that would prove out that this is going to, raising this threshold will ultimately save the city any money?
Chairman Brown, Representative Holvey, I haven't compiled any documentation on what it would save. It would be difficult to say to do that and compare the wages back from those previous projects. The other point you made, that there's a number of projects that would disappear, and yes, there's 48% of the projects would disappear from the prevailing wage, but I don't believe those projects are being done by the small contractors, because they aren't fulfilling or the requirements, or wouldn't have the time or energy to do the requirements of the prevailing wage legislation. And so most of those small projects are filler projects for larger out-of-community firms that are going to do them in between some of their larger projects, or as weather is not working with them in other locations, they'll come into the small community and complete those within the time frame. So I don't believe it's going to take away projects from the smaller firms and smaller corporations or companies or sole proprietorships that are within the communities. But we can get some of that information.
Richard, or someone testified that about a 4.8% of the dollars and 48% of the jobs. Are the dollars you're talking about, is that all public works contracts in the state of Oregon, or is that just cities or counties?
Chairman Brown, that is all public works dollars that qualify under BOLI projects. So it would eliminate, it's, and I think the number is actually 4.4% at $125,000, the dollars that would be eliminated from the bid process.
Chair Brown,
identify yourself.
Bob Avery, Chief of Staff Representative Hanna. You should have a additional spreadsheet that was developed. Kind of looks like this with some gray bars on it.
Yeah, lots of fingers.
That was developed with the information provided by BOLI on the contracts that they do, and we reorganized it, adding the percentages and adding the cumulative effect. If you look on that chart, the second set of gray bars, the first one is the subtotal of that range, and then the bottom number when there's two gray bars is the cumulative effect. So in the 03-05 biennium was the 48.7% of the numbers of contracts, and the 4.4% of the total dollars were included in BOLI only contracts.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative.
Chairman Brown, would you like us to talk about House Bill 2997?
Oh, yes.
At the same time?
Right. Why don't you go ahead and give your testimony on that, too?
Thank you, Chairman Brown. Again, for the record, Bruce Hanna, State Representative, House District 7. Again, in an effort to work my way around the district, this bill speaks to exemptions for projects with substantial volunteer and nonprofit contributions. Again, in terms of helping build Oregon from the community up, as I visited with these small communities, they talked about problems arising from regulations on public contracting when volunteers or nonprofit organizations attempt to partner with communities for relatively small projects such as park improvement, skateboard parks, and others. Specifically, the Little Davis Bacon or Bureau of Labor and Industries contracting provisions and how they impact these small communities. Currently, the law says any contract that uses public monies in excess of $25,000 is subject to the prevailing wage and other certification provisions within BOLI. There are existing exclusions for projects where no public funds are used. However, the law has been interpreted in such a way that when any public funds are used and the entire project exceeds $25,000, then the prevailing wage and other contracting provisions are triggered, regardless of how small the public portion of the project may be. Often when this occurs, the community can no longer afford or must delay the project. An example would be community groups join together to raise money and purchase a playground structure, but they need the assistance of the municipality's heavy equipment to help install it. Public funds paid in hourly wages to the equipment operator would trigger the current BOLI provision if the project exceeded the $25,000 threshold. This bill, 2997, is intended to do this. Contracts for which a community group or nonprofit organization contribute 50% or more of the value of the contract would be excluded from the prevailing wage and contracting provisions. When we discussed this bill with the various stakeholders, a concern was raised that the original bill might allow construction of a hospital, a nonprofit hospital, or a major university building project to be excluded if the bill was enacted as originally drafted. Good point. The Dash 1 amendments clarify that our bill is intended for small projects only by adding a $250,000 cap on the project. The $250,000 cap is suggested for several reasons. It's clear with today's costs, this is still a small project. Additionally, it's essentially two times the current limit, which we're suggesting for the limit to be raised, the $125,000, makes it easy to remember and work with. This past Thursday, we met with BOLI officials, and they indicated they may have an alternative method of achieving these specific desired results. subject to possible comments from them either today or at a potential meeting on Wednesday with the work group that we've mentioned and stakeholders that we've met with, we would be open to delaying the movement of this bill to allow them time to develop possible amendments. Once again, the intention of this bill is to help cut the red tape for small communities. Again, please help us encourage public, private, and nonprofit partnership in participation to help build Oregon from the community up. Let's take some of the barriers out of the way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Richard, please go ahead and give your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Brown. Richard Myers, the city manager in Cottage Grove. And as I mentioned earlier, we are an All-America City for 2004. And as an All-America City, we have a lot of public participation in events and activities that go on inside the community. A couple of years ago, and the city is in support of this bill, 2997, and the -1 amendments. A couple of years ago, the city had worked with a group of youth within our community that were looking for a skate park. They were riding in our main park underneath our band gazebo and destroying the gazebo area and damaging other things in the area, riding their skateboards, and wanted a place that was built for skateboards. We told them, okay, we'll help you as much as we can, and we tried to find pieces of vacant land that the city already owned that would be possible sites for their skate park. They formed an association and started working with the Cottage Grove Recreation Association and partnered with them as well and settled on a site that was an old parking lot that we were using as a park and ride location for the crummies and for other workers that needed to get up in the woods or ride to Eugene, that they'd park there. So we gave them part of that parking lot and said, and we can give it to them, we said, you can use a portion of that parking lot and design your skate park. We required that they come back to us with the design and some information and so for approvals by the city. And at that time, we also contacted a representative from the Bureau of Labor and Industries in Eugene and said, here's what we're doing. This, we believe, does not trigger prevailing wage rates. And we got an affirmative from the employee in Eugene. The project began, some work was being done, and we received a letter from the Bureau of Labor and Industries out of Salem saying the project has been determined to be a prevailing wage project because it's being built on city property, hence city resources are being used, you have to pay prevailing wage. In turn, we had to shut down this private association, nonprofit group from constructing their skate park and tell them to cease and desist until prevailing wage rates were taken care of. The park sat there for about 6 months as the community was looking at this partially constructed skate park being done by a small contractor that was working and donating a lot of labor and time and working with youth actually in doing a lot of the work on the skate park. Eventually, we did get the Bureau of Labor and Industries to review the case again, and they determined that even though the city had waived the building permit fees, which we paid the state portion of the building permit fees because they said that wasn't a waiver because we paid the state portion, which we had to pay anyway, and because we did some engineering review of the design, that under the law and under the administrative rules, design of a project is not a prevailing wage responsibility or doesn't trigger it. It's not a use of public funds. But they then determined that, okay, it's not a prevailing wage. We were able to move forward with the project. Another project we just completed this last year was an improvement in Coiner Park. The Rotary Club, in celebrating their 100th anniversary, wanted to do new playground equipment in our park and pull out several old pieces of playground equipment that were probably pre-World War II. These pieces of equipment were not safe anymore, needed to be removed. We were constantly repairing pieces and parts. The Rotary Club, and after working with the Skate Park Association, we told them, You can use the park piece. You can develop this location. But we're going to be completely out of this again. We can't help you in any way, shape, or form. We would have loved to have partnered with the Rotary Club and been able to possibly add an extra piece of equipment or give them some aid or assistance in digging the dirt out and providing the safe play surface. But they were able to do it all by themselves, and their project, I believe, ended up costing somewhere around $90,000. No work from the city crews. Our backhoe was across the street at City Shop and couldn't come over and help them in any way, or shape, or form to move equipment, to place equipment, to dig the holes, or to do anything in any way to help them and possibly make the project a little bigger for the community. So those are the reasons that we're looking at this, that there needs to be something for small communities especially, and some of the larger communities are having this issue as well, where citizens groups are actually taking an active role in the governance and operations of their communities and getting into the barn raising again, where they're being a part of it, and they'd love to have the city be a part. Some of the comments we get from downtown businesses or people that aren't aware of what's going on is, oh, the Rotary Club did that project and the city didn't have anything to do with it. And it's like, oh, the city doesn't want to help do anything. We're only there to run law enforcement or do the library, but we're not helping with anything. We would have loved to have helped with some of those projects and made them better, but we just couldn't because it would have triggered the prevailing wage and made it out of reach for the Rotary Club to have done what they did.
Thank you, Richard. Any questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said, Richard, you said the Rotary Club spent $90,000 on that project. Did obviously they paid some wages to somebody in that?
Yes, Representative Brown and Representative Shields. The Rotary Club did pay. They contracted with the playground equipment company. Most of the project was actual equipment. Playground equipment isn't cheap anymore. And they contracted with the playground equipment supplier to actually have some consultants come down and assist them in installing it so that they could install it correctly, since our crew couldn't help and make sure things got level and placed square and stuff like that. They had the contractor come down and assist them that way.
Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Let's see. Could I have Bob Shiprack and Ed Glad, please? Good morning, Bob. Would you like to start, please?
Sure. Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I want to take 2 minutes, maybe, at Chair's discretion or direction. I wanted to make sure the committee's absolutely aware of what the prevailing wage laws are in the first place. I'm just wondering if you're all that familiar with these, since we haven't really had.
You know, I think that my history serves me right that both the Davis-Bacon Act and the Little Davis-Bacon Act were good Republican legislation.
One was
good history.
Indeed, Representative Bacon and Davis were Republicans, I believe, from New York State, and was signed by Herbert Hoover in 1931.
I remember it well.
The Little Davis-Bacon Act was signed by the Honorable Mark Hatfield in 1959. They still work today, and I just wanted to I'll preface my remarks because I think this is a good time to have a discussion about this bill as well as the other bills you're having on the agenda today. Certainly the other bills following this, as I said to one of the folks from the counties, none of this is landmark legislation, but it attempts to try and fix a lot of little problems with the current law, and things change and circumstances change, but I'll direct specifically my remarks to 2996. The testimony is accurate in that 1995 there was probably the biggest change in Oregon's prevailing wage law. This was interestingly enough, following ballot measure 12, which was on the ballot in 1994, some of my circle of friends put that on the ballot, and it was handily defeated 63-37 statewide. It would have repealed Oregon's prevailing wage law. It was defeated in every single county in the state. I got those election results if anyone wants to see those. So the public likes prevailing wage laws, and for a variety of reasons. What we did in 1995 is we kind of divorced ourselves from the federal law, the Davis-Bacon Act. The Davis-Bacon Act applies to any project over $2,000, so any federal projects. Davis-Bacon kicks in at $2,000. I'll talk more about how that rate's determined in another bill, but the federal government occasionally surveys construction contractors to find out what the prevailing wage is by county. We just finished one about 2 years ago. We're still waiting for them to publish some results. In 95, we said we're going to start modernizing the way we do prevailing wage surveys. And today, over 10,000 contractors a year are surveyed as to what they pay in wages and fringe benefits based upon geographical locations. So the intent of the law all along was to reflect area standard wages and benefits. And today, Boley publishes this book twice a year. And you can look up in this book your district if you want. It's by county or region. There's 14 regions. And based upon the results of the survey that the Employment Department collates and then the Bureau of Labor certifies, that then you can look up and see what the prevailing wages are in these communities, again, to reflect what's actually paid in the community. And it varies widely depending on the craft. One of the things that was asked, and I stopped by my office this morning, I have a whole file on prevailing wage studies. This is the last one, the most recent one I've got, and it's the impact of wages on highway construction costs, which I'll leave with the committee. It's an amazing survey. It was done by the Construction Labor Research Council, and it points out in high wage states, and Oregon's one of them, that the actual cost per mile of roadway or bridges is actually in the top, a very high level as far as low cost per mile. So there's a direct relationship in this study between high wages and productivity. Texas, I might add, at $11.82 an hour, which is less than half of Oregon's, as their costs are still a third higher per mile installed. So I just throw that out is because the basis of prevailing wage laws are not only to reflect local wages and fringe benefits, but it's to also have a skilled workforce available for productivity purposes, and also because public works projects generally tend to be we build 50-year buildings, sometimes 100-year buildings, obviously streets, sidewalks, utilities, and things like that are designed to last, so they would want a qualified workforce. Getting specifically to the bill, I am concerned, and I've been a long time since I looked at those numbers, about 10 years actually. I'm concerned over the large number of small projects and the impact on contractors that it may have. Construction's generally a small business endeavor, and to exempt that number of projects deeply concerns me. partly because one of the reasons we have prevailing wage laws is to ensure that the contractors have a level playing field. And in fact, that's why Mr. Davis and Bacon introduced the bill back in, actually they introduced the bill in 29, was signed in 31. They had a hospital in their district. The Depression had just got started, and an out-of-state contractor came in with their workers and took the job away. So one of the reasons we have the laws is to provide a level playing field for contractors to bid, not based on how cheap they pay their workers, but on how good a contractors they really are. Raising the threshold also would put us near the top, and I think Representative Hanna alluded to that. Many states have no threshold. The threshold being contemplated would put us, I believe, second or third highest in the country, which is quite a ways up there. I'm going to finish with just a couple thoughts. We often hear about this onerous, burdensome paperwork, and I've always wondered about that. And it was mentioned, what the contractor has to do is they have to file a certified payroll. It's a weekly payroll, but it's submitted once a month. And it's a certified payroll. All you do is you write down the employee's name, how many hours they worked, what their classification was, labor, carpenter, electrician, whatever, and their fringe benefits. It's what you have to do to pay taxes. I mean, it's basic payroll information that you turn over to the public contracting agency in order to make sure that you are, in fact, complying with the law. If that's burdensome, I don't know what they're doing with state revenue and the IRS. I've always wondered about that. I've talked about the savings just to... Instead of bringing my whole file, I'm not going to spend any more much time on this, but there have been a number of studies done on prevailing wage across the country. An interesting thing happened in Michigan. They suspended their law in 1994 until May of 1997. There was a court ruling that said it was ERISA preempted. During that time, afterwards, they took a study of what the impact was on construction while the act was repealed. Costs actually were higher after the act was repealed for public works than before and after. Don't ask me how to explain that, but there's the numbers, the graphs. I'll be happy to leave this with you. Other states, particularly for school construction, have been measured, and I appreciate the proponents of the bill saying that there was no evidence that it saves money. There probably isn't. I can't find any in all the studies that I've found. I reject the onerous paperwork issue. But, Mr. Chairman, it's been a pleasure working with Representative Hanna. It is a concern in this building. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss what our prevailing wage law does in this state. It works well, and I'm prepared to continue the discussions, and that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions? Don't see any, Ed. Your turn now.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. My name is Ed Glad with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I wanted to compliment Bob. He has a great presentation. He's probably had to explain prevailing wage to more groups than I ever will. I think that one of the things that I would like to reiterate that Bob has already said is that, first of all, we have to remember that prevailing wage rates are about wages. It's about the workers that receive these wages. And it was very interesting that in 1994 that the state had before it the opportunity to repeal the prevailing wage laws. And in every single county, I mean, we're talking about Wheeler County even, you know, stepping up and saying, no, we believe in this. And I think that in the counties that have small towns, that they don't have large towns, that the people are pushing back and saying, you know, we really do believe in the area standard wages, that's an important thing to recognize and to honor among the people that receive the wages themselves. Going on to House Bill 2997, I would like to make a couple of comments with regards to that bill. I myself live in a small town, Yamhill, Oregon, and I have been asked by a number of the people in the community to participate in the establishment of a 501c3 nonprofit organization to be able to raise money from the public to supplement and promote the various programs, whether they're in the classroom or extracurricular activities at the high school and at the elementary schools. That process of establishing ourselves as a 501c3 has been very enlightening. Whenever you dig further than your 1040 form, and either your 1040 form when you fill out taxes is complicated enough, but when you get to fill out your 501c3 status form to the IRS, you find out that the criteria that they use in order to be able to honor somebody who is saying that they are a nonprofit organization is the criteria that anybody would use, that when you have public dollars, that you utilize those public dollars the way that you've chartered yourself to be. A 501c nonprofit organization is essentially entrusted with public care of money that people are entrusting to that 501c3 to use that money correctly and not to transgress the public trust. What's been fascinating in the process of setting this up is that the research that I did is found out that in Washington, D.C. is the most number of 501c3 nonprofit organizations. They're located right there where the heart of the government is. The second most dense place in terms of population of 501c3s is in Portland, Oregon. When you look at the way that we have been operating here in Oregon for the last 15 years, we've seen a major shift over to small communities taking care of themselves outside of the tax structure. In order to do that, 501c3s have been popping up all over the place. So there is already, even before we've been granted that nonprofit status, there's been requests from the school in Yamhill for our little organization to participate in the development not only of physical classroom space but playgrounds as well as other program opportunities that would fall under public dollars if it was delivered through the tax system. But now that we're moving into a new era of asking the booster clubs and the educational foundation to supply the funds for that, we are up against this challenge that we're seeing here in 2997, is how far can we go as a group to rebuild or to install brand new physical facilities on the grounds of our public property. They become assets, obviously, of the school district. They are built by public dollars, but not public dollars, tax dollars. They're built by public dollars contributions. And so the challenge for us when we look at prevailing wage is when those assets are public assets, are we basically telling our small communities, are the workers in those small communities, the contractors that bid in those small communities, no, we're going to pay you less? I don't know how many of our representatives are willing to go out to their district saying that I came back and advocated to pay our people less just so that they could have more. It's not a very good argument for the folks that in every single county have voted to support the prevailing wage. Bob was very instrumental in the rewrite of the construction of how we do prevailing wage, how we survey what the area standards are. And I think that that is something that we need to continue to respect, that our people here in the state of Oregon do know about prevailing wage. They are aware of the effects that it has on their home pocketbook. And I would be open to any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Don't see any.
I did have just one comment on 2997, if we're doing that one, I assume. I, again, Bob Shipwreck, Building Trades. I I really appreciate Representative Hanna talking to Boley. I've read this bill so many times. I still, the printed bill, I don't know how it would work, and I've told his staff that. However, in the discussions I've had with Representative Hanna, it was apparent to me that there were two issues that needed to be fixed. Two sessions ago, I worked with the Labor Commissioner Roberts on trying to write the language for use of volunteers on these types of projects, and I'm told that it's not exactly clear. So I spoke to Boley myself last week, and they have agreed to work on it, as Representative Hanna said, to look at clarifying what indeed is volunteer labor and clarify when the prevailing wage applies on volunteer projects. And I think that gets to the issue that he's attempting to solve here. So I'm hopeful that that'll be done.
Thank you, Lon. Mm-hmm. And committee, Bob had a number of items there that he has information there, and I've asked Janet to make sure that each of us on the committee get that information. Thank you again for this one. Could I have John O'Shell and Christy Monson? Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Brown, members of the committee. I'm John O'Shell, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon County. I've been working with the Public Works Project for approximately 30 years. I'm very familiar with the topic. Chair Brown, did you want us to speak to both bills at this
point? Yes, please.
Okay. First of all, Association of Oregon Counties stands neutral as to the coverage of prevailing wages. We have county commissioners that are very strong advocates for the need of prevailing wage to protect employees. We have very strong advocates of saying, but why should we be paying more on a prevailing wage project than a regular private project? I take no side on that issue, but they are strong positions on both sides. We are generally just concerned on making sure that whatever language comes up is administratively clear. On this particular bill, probably should mention impacts. There's just tons and tons of intangible impacts. There is certainly an administrative savings. I would tell you that personal opinion, while it's there, compared with the policy issues involved, it's a small number. So I wouldn't have that drive your decisions particularly. Probably an intangible that hasn't been mentioned is certainly if we drop the prevailing wage out to projects up to 125, there's probably a number of projects that would be done by county crews that would go to contract. Once again, on the perception that the contracting cost is less, even before we hit that $125,000 threshold that's required by law for us to compare costs, most counties are looking at the cost for contract versus doing their own forces way before they get to that threshold. So how much? Couldn't tell you, but there certainly will be a few. Once again, my suspicion, probably not enough to drive your decisions on the policy issues, just letting you know impacts. On the House Bill 2997 regarding the regarding the volunteer work and so forth. Once again, policy is to do it or not. We're neutral. We just want to make sure it is clear. We would hope to have as clear enough that we don't have to go to Boley each time and ask for a decision. Those of you who have worked with volunteer projects, they are a moving target as to whether you're working with a citizen volunteer, a contractor volunteer, a donated material volunteer, and as those projects are being built, they are really a moving target. Hopefully this can be made clear enough that the agency could make the determination without having to make a request each time. That's all I have to say unless you have any questions.
Why don't we go ahead and take the rest of the testimony and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Christy Munson for the League of Oregon Cities. We just wanted to thank you, first of all, for hearing these bills, and we look forward to participating in any work group with anybody with the other interest groups. And had three comments. The first being, which we've heard several interest groups talk, and I don't necessarily hear any mutually exclusive or necessarily conflicting interests. We are not asking for a repeal of the prevailing wage rate. What we are asking for is certain considerations for when your communities are working together and doing what they've been calling barn raising exercises, where you have an energized community. And so we're looking at a small incremental change in how prevailing wage rate is applied for small contracts. And we are talking about small contracts. As you know from my prior testimony on other bills, my experts tell me that it costs about $250,000 to resurface a mile of road. So we're not talking about large contracts. And I think we can preserve and honor our workers and our community volunteers with small incremental changes in that prevailing wage rate. Secondly, if you haven't guessed already, excuse my voice, we're in support of 2996 and 2997. We do have some questions about the definitions and are willing to work with all parties involved to talk about those. But regarding the threshold bill, we've heard comment that perhaps the cost savings isn't there, or perhaps it's not documented. One thing I'd like to pose to the committee just to think about is perhaps this wouldn't be an issue if the cost savings weren't there. This is an issue, we're talking about it, so there's likely some kind of cost savings there. Just wanted to call particular attention to the Dash 1s, Representative Hannah, Dash 1s with the $250,000 cap. We believe that's reasonable. We hope you do, too. And just lastly, I think this offers you a great opportunity to strike a fair balance for your citizens who are working very hard, volunteer hours, working with their cities, and for your workers. I don't think that it's not necessarily mutually exclusive. So thank you.
Thank you, Christy. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you both for your testimony. Could I have Jeff Dean and Steve Snyder?
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Dean. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2996, and as well as the Dash 2 amendments, which would bring it to $125,000. As you've heard before, Oregon's prevailing wage threshold has not been looked at or changed in over 10 years. As a result of that, many of ABC's members that I've spoken to will not perform work on public contracts simply because they will hit the threshold so quickly. You've heard some about discussion regarding the paperwork involved with dealing with prevailing wage, and many of ABC's members simply choose not to go there. We would appreciate your consideration of passing this bill, and I believe that it would open up a great number of businesses as well as contracts to Oregon small contractors. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Steve.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Steve Schneider, representing Schneider Equipment and Drilling Company, and also the Oregon Groundwater Association. I'm the legislative chairman for that association, which is a group of primarily contractors in the water systems and drilling industry. We support House Bill 2996. The amendments I'm a little confused on yet. I understand there's a Dash 1 and a Dash 2, and we support any kind of increase in the threshold. None of them sounded excessive by any means. In fact, I don't believe they go far enough. To clarify a few things, though, I want to, I think it was unfortunately Representative Hovey who just stepped out, but he had asked about what some of the complications are, administrative headaches and whatnot that a contractor deals with in dealing with prevailing wage. Let me go through some of the routine. First of all, you have to select a classification for the type of work. Typical small contractors aren't used to doing this. They're typically probably not a union contractor. They aren't set the terminology that goes on in the typical union workforce is not common throughout the state. the classification selection is supposedly done out of the little booklet Bob Shiprack previously displayed to you. It's put out every 6 months by Boley. And we found that it's often confusing and complicated. In fact, it was so confusing and complicated, I testified in front of this committee last week as to some of the actions taken against our company. And it was related to selection of classification. Pursuant to that litigation against our company, Boley actually changed the definition to where some of the work that was under question, which had to do with handrail installations, got specifically now defined as to be done by ironworkers. And I'm not quite sure what the carpenters think of that, because I think they're more appropriate at putting those in, but that's what happened. That whole issue is very complex, and Boley has not been real forthcoming at incorporating questioned works, tasks, into the booklets. We've seen quite a few requests for interpretations, communications back and forth to and from that agency that have never been addressed in rule. An example might be who actually is classified to put in water plumbing when it's 5 foot outside of a building. It's a laborer, believe it or not, but as soon as it crosses the magic line to being within 5 feet, it's a plumber. That's not in the publication, but yet that's how it's enforced. So classification selection is the first problem. Once you have that classification, you now have to go through a detailed analysis of the timesheets that the employee typically fills out. And you need to make sure, based on what they are saying they're doing, you may switch that classification throughout the day. This creates, now we have multiple pay scales. The pay scale I addressed last week also in House Bill 2476 gets complicated, because if they hit overtime, we now have a major complication in dealing with how to compute daily overtime. Many contractors in our industry also report to their base work and then head out to do the work at the job site. Typically, we pay all the same rate if it's not subject to public, is not a public works contract. So the travel time at the shop, loading up, unloading, whatever, on site, it's all paid the same. A very simple system. All one rate, no big deal. Prevailing wage was set up on the principle that typically it's larger construction projects, and the employees, the constructors, typically show up at the job site. There's no travel time involved, etc. So it really creates a difference in methodology and within the system. It also creates a problem with morale among employees. You may have one employee that's all of a sudden subject to a prevailing wage getting some different wage than another guy doing the same sort of work. So within small companies, that creates a morale problem. The certified payroll forms, they're another form. There's not a computer software program, payroll software program, that does accounting that includes those, to my knowledge, and can do all of the calculations. The payroll forms, they got increased, I think, last session to where it is required every week now and to be submitted monthly. It is additional paperwork, and especially as we get into multiple hours of pay during a pay period. Another reason contractors don't like to do it is the penalties. The penalties can be severe for any violation, even unintentioned violations of prevailing wage laws, and I can attest to this firsthand. Our company was subjected to a $21,000 fine and debarment.
Steve, I'm going to run out of time, so I need you to sort of summarize your testimony.
Okay. We were innocent. Moving on, crediting fringe benefits is one other headache that small contractors have to use in calculating the amount of prevailing wage. Overall, we support 2996, also support 2997. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you much. And is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2996 or 2997? And then I'll close the public hearing on 2996 and 2997 and open the public hearing on, I can't find my sheet, House Bill 2710. And with that, Representative Holby.
You want me to go down front there?
You can work from right there if you'd like.
Okay, great. I'm just going to start this off a little bit. House Bill 2710, and I've got some Dash 1 amendments before you this morning as well. Is really to address a specific situation where we have both federal funds and state funds on prevailing wage job. There's oftentimes confusion between the different surveys as to what the actual wage is, and we've had some problems with federal surveys being outdated and lacking the correct classification for a particular craft on certain projects. And we also have a problem with going county to county and seeing wages drastically change from one county to county on projects. So House Bill 2710 and the Dash 1 amendment is intended to somewhat stabilize the wages and protect the wages of workers, as well as make it more unified throughout the state. It basically asks that when there's both federal and state wages applying to a particular job, that we pick the higher of the two wages as the one that prevails for that project according to that classification. I've talked to several contractors who oftentimes have trouble finding workers that will go to a certain part of the state to do highway work when that particular wage is quite a bit lower than the county next to it. So in order for them to get their skilled workers to travel to do a lot of our bridge projects in the OTIA investments that we're making around this state, it would be good if we could be upfront with what that wage is, take the confusion away from the contractor so that they know exactly what the wage is before they start the project. I've also talked to ODOT about this somewhat, trying to figure out what kind of impact this has. I'm not sure. There's very small amount of actual wage impact, fiscal impact to the agency, 1 to 2% perhaps. And there's also potentially some cost savings and not having to renegotiate contracts because the lower wage was paid when it shouldn't have been. And I'm going to leave it at that and let somebody else testify. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Could I have Ed Glad and Christy Hammond and Bob Shiprack, please? Why don't we start with you, Bob? Again,
Oh, okay. That's good, because I'm going to be real quick.
Okay.
Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building Trades Council. Representative Holfe pretty well put this in parameters as to what the intent of this bill is. One thing I don't think he mentioned, this bill is copied from the Washington state law, where it's been in effect for quite a while. I don't know how many years, to be honest with you. So it's not unprecedented. The intent, just to go a little bit further on the one point that I started to allude to in my earlier testimony, we have a problem with the Davis-Bacon surveys. They're conducted irregularly. They try and do them every 8 years. Sometimes they do it, sometimes they don't.
the last published rates that we've got are from 1992. There was a survey in the late 90s which was thrown out. As I said earlier, we just finished one almost 2 years ago. It takes them forever to also publish these rates. So the issue you have is you have a federal survey system that can take up to, looking at the timelines I've just discussed and what they'll admit to, about 11 years in between surveys from when it's published and done. The problem with that is if you don't prevail in a federal Davis-Bacon survey, your rate is frozen. And so we have four counties in Oregon where that happened in 1992 with wage rates as low as $10 an hour, no fringe benefits. They've been frozen there since 1992, and it's made a joke out of the Davis-Bacon wages. The intent of this bill would be to, if in fact there were rates that didn't prevail in a certain county, in a certain classification, we could fall back perhaps on our annual state wage surveys that, again, are conducted annually.
Thank you, Bob. Christy, would you like to be next, please?
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm Christy Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And you have a letter from Commissioner Gardner supporting House Bill 2710. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the surveys that are conducted by both the Bureau of Labor and Industries and the U.S. Department of Labor. You've already heard that the Bureau of Labor and Industries administers and enforces the state prevailing wage rate law, which applies to public works construction projects in Oregon that are carried on or contracted for by a state or local public agency. And if the project is over $25,000 and is not regulated by the Federal Davis-Bacon Act. In 1995, the legislature established a policy regarding the prevailing wage rate and published 4 points that were declared as the purposes of the prevailing wage rate law, and you can see those in the letter that I provided to you. In 1997, the legislature required the Bureau of Labor and Industries to conduct an annual construction industry survey and to use the data collected from that survey in establishing and publishing the prevailing wage rates. And we've been doing that we've conducted the first survey, actually, in 1996, but we've been using survey data for the publication of the prevailing wage rate since 1998. One of the main differences between the state and federal survey is in the state survey, virtually every construction contractor in the state is surveyed, and construction contractors are required to respond to the survey and can actually be assessed penalties if they do not respond to the survey. In contrast, the federal survey is voluntary, and contractors are not required to submit data for the federal survey. The U.S. Department of Labor advised us that they estimate that only 15 to 20% of eligible contractors who have data actually respond to their survey. As Mr. Shiprack indicated, the federal surveys are sporadic, their methodology is controversial, and the rates they publish are frequently seriously outdated by as much as 20 years. I actually looked up some Davis-Bacon rates on the internet and found that in Curry County, the last wage rates published were have been in effect since 1983. A wage rate for truck drivers that's published for Curry County is $5.25 an hour, which is actually below the state minimum wage rate. Also, I found some wage rates for Josephine County that have been in effect for 14 years. An example of a low wage rate there is for roofers, $8 an hour with no fringe benefits. So this is an illustration of how old and out of date federal wage rates can be. House Bill 2710 would require the payment of the higher of either the state or federal prevailing wage rates to be paid to workers employed on state and local public works projects. As I indicated, the current law exempts projects with federal funds that are regulated under the federal law. This would repeal that exemption. We believe that this legislation would ensure stability in the wage rates paid to workers employed on all public works projects in Oregon subject to the prevailing wage rate law, and further ensure that Oregon workers are paid fairly and consistent with labor market realities. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Christy. Ed?
Very briefly, I agree. I think that my name is Ed Glad. I'm with the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters, and we obviously participate with the Bureau of Labor and Industries in being able to determine what is the community standard wages, and when the federal government steps in with money to help us on various projects. And I think that really, when you look at these projects that we're talking about, it's mainly the ODOT projects, is that the challenge is to be able to make sure that there is enough workforce in the area that is satisfied with their wages. If they have to move from one county to the other, and all of a sudden, because the federal Davis-Bacon rates apply, then there is a tendency, and we've seen it on the union side, of a lot of people that have pulled back, saying, you know what, it's easier to stay at home than to go to the next door county or three or four counties away and work for a significantly lower wage. The strategies also in the OTIA projects, as you know, has developed so that there are large blocks of bridge replacement and road capping that is going on that goes across several different counties. When the Bureau has the ability to mix and match with regards to the various areas, you know, in looking at the wages, they're able to take a road that goes beyond a single county, which is, you know, is locked in by the federal rates, that the Bureau has the ability to actually massage that a little to make the prevailing wage rates apply to the entire projects if necessary. So the carpenters certainly agree that this is a needed change to keep Oregon working. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you.
Hey, this is the first
yeah,
question.
In my shop today. Anyway, my wife's back in town, so I got to
see you now.
Mr. Shiprack, you know, I know for a fact that the building trades, and that including carpenters and teamsters and all them too, are not out here to make employers and municipalities and governments' life miserable. I know that for a fact. As a matter of fact, I've found that you have been supportive in legislative and policy for a revenue system that attracts investment, flexibility in land use laws, reasonable use of our natural resources, sustainable use, so we can create the jobs that are and generate the revenue that are help medicate, educate, incarcerate folks. I guess my question to you is, and I don't think you're going to have the answer, but last week we heard about this the prevailing wage and all the burden, some paperwork and the calculation. It was alluded to again today. I'm requesting it, and I asked the Bowley to go look for this too. If there's any software out there in other states that have a small Davis-Bacon Act, state Davis-Bacon Act, that would help employers. If it's burdensome, fine. Personally, I work for an employer that there would be as few as three of us sometimes. So now I think he has about 20, 25 guys working. But he'd get down to his office staff was greater than his labor staff. Fortunately, I was one of the guys that wasn't laid off. But because I one thing about an organized labor workforce, if you ain't hustling, you're down the road. So it does attract the best and the brightest and the most qualified, and they're a very trained workforce. If you would go out and ask your building trades folks in other states if there are any software, if anybody's working on any software, they're going to, because that's one thing I'd like to get off the camel's back, that supposed, alleged, burdensome paperwork. Because in the gentleman's defense, not every contractor has an accounting bookkeeping department, and a lot of times they are ma and pa operations. So if you could just go look for that, I'd appreciate it. And I think that's the direction I'd like to see the state go in too, so we can get that monkey off our back and help small business, by the way, too, and let them save money and just be one thing, one argument that we can get rid of as far as paying living wages and benefits here in the state of Oregon. Or one argument we could get rid of that is, in my opinion, opposed to paying living wages and benefits here in the state of Oregon. So that's just my request. That's about all I have to say.
So it's directed to me. I would share just one brief story. I was working on a volunteer project, if you can imagine, for the Oregon Food Bank. And believe it or not, the owner was going to refuse some federal funding because of the onerous paperwork of the Davis-Bacon Act. We had Walsh Construction, who, you know, Bob Walsh, by Raleigh, there's a lot of work in the city of Portland, not statewide. And we sat down with the owner, and he goes, what are you thinking about? He says, the way I'm set up, and he does a lot of affordable housing and things like that with both state and federal prevailing wages, he says, my system is set up, I just hit a button, and it spits out the certified payroll. So I'll go talk to Bob, but he's already done it several years ago.
Thank you.
Chair Brown and Representative Toffler, may I... there are currently Excel spreadsheets that are available to do some of the more basic computations. I think what Mr. Schneider was talking about last week and where we could explore the possibility of getting some software that would be helpful is in the area of doing some of the weighted average overtime computations where there are multiple rates of pay. And frankly, that's a problem for our own compliance specialists to have to do some of those computations. And we are looking at programs that might help them as well as employers. And we have an advisory committee that we can also use to help us develop those.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Christy, can you tell me if Boley's had a chance to check with any other states that have a similar bill like House Bill 2710? I know I pulled some of this from Washington State and to see if they have any complications with implementing this.
Chair Brown, Representative Holby, I too contacted the state of Washington, and their law has been in effect since 1988, and the person with their prevailing wage rate unit with whom I spoke indicated that it really hadn't been a very big problem in enforcing the law there, and that it did help in some of the eastern counties in Washington where the federal rates were particularly out of date. But again, it was, she said they hadn't had experienced any real difficulties in enforcing the law or contractors having a hard time complying with their law.
We'll follow up. One more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Christy, also as part of this bill, I don't know if you've had time to look at the Dash 1 amendment on this bill yet, but it's basically aimed at ensuring that the contracting agency, you know, get the information of the specific wage rates for the classifications to the contractor to take that burden off the contractor to having to wade through the different survey books to actually pick it out. Do you see that as something that can be achieved by the contracting agency without a tremendous amount of problems?
Representative Holby, it's very easy to include both the state prevailing wage rates and the applicable Davis-Bacon rates in the specifications for a public contract. As I indicated, the Davis-Bacon rates are downloadable from a website, and these are our prevailing wage rates. So I believe your amendment would require that the public agency provide both sets of applicable wage rates so that a contractor would be able to determine which were the higher rates for the particular area and classification.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, folks, for your testimony. Could I have John Jackley, John O'Shell, and Christy Monson? Morning, John. We'll start with you, okay?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm John Jackley with the Highway Division at the Department of Transportation. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today. As you know, House Bill 2710 would require us and other state agencies to pay the higher of the prevailing wage, state or federal. Our projects often have a mix, sometimes complicated, of state, federal, and local funds, and that can change over time. Currently, if a project, as you know, has any federal funds at all, it's what we call federalized, and the federal prevailing wage rate must be paid. If there aren't any federal funds in a project, the state rate is applied. The Federal Highway Administration reimburses us for the cost of building federal highway projects. The money's not available till the work's done. And in most cases where the state prevailing wage rate is higher than the federal rate, Federal Highway wouldn't reimburse us for the difference. We did a little bit of looking into the potential impact of this bill. And as you know, labor is roughly 20% of our construction costs. And on a statewide basis, the difference between state and federal rates could range from about 1 to 2%, with 2% being on the very, very high end. Our 2004 construction program, just to give you an example, was approximately $424 million. And when you look at the labor costs of that, factored in by the potential differences in this bill, we're looking at an average project cost increase of maybe $2,000 to $4,000. And it's probably closer to the lower range of that. I think that probably summarizes our issue. The impact, as I said, when you look at the large kind of construction program that we have, is about $2,000 to $4,000, again, most likely on the lower range. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
John, we heard testimony that, down in Curry County, the truck drivers under the federal prevailing wage was $5 and something an hour. So if we had a highway contract in that area and there's some federal dollars involved, then the federal prevailing wage would be what the contractor would be obligated to follow?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, that's correct.
And so the state prevailing wage would not be used, probably?
That's correct.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, thanks for coming to share ODOT's concerns with the bill and your perspectives on it. I know you mentioned the somewhat minimal potential cost that 2710 would cause in wages. Do you foresee, I know that sometimes ODOT has been required to renegotiate projects because they the projects were awarded with a lower wage and later on was either federalized or had money in it that required a higher wage. And just trying to do a reality check that situation does occur occasionally because of a lower wage being paid, and that this bill would perhaps keep that from happening and potentially save ODOT the cost from renegotiating bids. Is that a fair statement?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, any fiscal impact created by the bill would be offset because that kind of situation most likely wouldn't happen in the event the bill became law.
Thank you.
And John, then if the state prevailing wage is used, does that any way jeopardize the federal dollars being part of that project?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, it doesn't jeopardize federal dollars for the entire project, but the state highway fund would have to make up the difference between the state rate and the federal rate should the state rate be higher. Again, it's in the context of our overall construction program. It's not a significant amount of money, but it is something that the state highway fund would have to make up.
All right. Thank you. John?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, John O'Shell, Association of Oregon Counties. Again, related to the policy issues, Association of Oregon Counties stands neutral. Our concerns are at the administrative. That comes in two forms. As I understand, the bill as written basically each employee, we would have to figure out the rate under both systems, basically every time they changed what piece of equipment they were on. By my knowledge of those two sets of books, often it's apples and oranges, because you know, one might be by county, one might be by region. When they do their breaks on different sizes of piece of equipment, the breaks might not be the same place. I'm concerned about the complexity of that and the contractors being able to do that easily. The second area of concern is how the agency administers the compliance is different on the federal law than the state law, and right now it's not clear which compliance system we use. And so once again, our issue is, you know, we believe that, you know, when we have a contract, we should be able to tell the contractor what wages he's supposed to be able to use and what process he's supposed to be able to use. We would like to see somehow the language worked, and frankly, I don't have a proposal yet because I'm still trying to figure it out myself, so that it is clear to the contractor what wages he is going to pay, and it is clear what administrative process he is going to use. With those clarifications, our problems go away.
All right. Thank you, John. Christy?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Christine Munson with the League, and with the chair's leave, I'd like to save the committee a little time and just note that the League is has questions and concerns and would like to participate on the work group regarding 2710, 3381, 3382, and 3383.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. Could I have Jeff Dean, Steve Schneider, and John Killian? And John, I want to apologize for overlooking you on the list. We'll make up for it.
We'll try to be quick and keep moving here.
Why don't we start with you?
Okay. Chair Brown, members of the committee, John Killen, for the record, representing the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. For the record, real quickly, 2926 and 2927, we're very much in favor. Then I'll move on from there. 2710, I'd like to first start off by thanking Representative Schaffler for his comments and requests to help out the small contractor. I and my members would very much appreciate that sort of help. It's confusing, it's difficult. They call me a lot, and frankly, I have a hard time working with a lot of it. On the same note, thank you, Representative Holley, for working some of those details into this bill. At the same time, we're still concerned. We got some details we need to work out on our side of it. My guys tend to say it's simple now. Why mess with it? If it's federal, it goes federal. If it's state, it goes state. And it's really confusing to figure out which is which and which is higher. I actually sat down just for electricians. It took me about half an hour to figure out. I guess I covered most of the state and figured out which one was higher. But it did. It took a while, and that was just for electricians, one little subset. So with that, I will ask for any questions and move on.
Yeah.
Yes, for the record, my name is Jeff Dean. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors. I'd briefly just reiterate a lot of what you've heard already. We do appreciate the ultimate goal of this bill to make things easier on the contractors, although we're not sure that this is the right vessel to do that. We are in opposition to it. Some of the concerns that came out of our membership as well were how federal grants would play into this. Currently, a federal grant would trigger the federal prevailing wage on any project, and a bill such as this may lead to higher costs on that as well. So with that, I'd answer any questions.
Thank you. Steve?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Steve Schneider, again with Schneider Equipment and Drilling. We oppose this bill mainly on the lack of compatibility between federal laws and state laws. Overtime plays into that. This is part of compensation. Federal does not have daily overtime. House Bill 2476 proposed to repeal that. To me, that kind of ties right into 2710. if we looked at them both together, I think would be a smart thing to do. Also, there are classification differences that will compound the problems for contractors selecting. And I found this myself working in Washington, where I found the federal rates didn't clarify properly who did what. I had to go to the state. The state was clear enough in that case, in that particular situation, and it took me a while to get that resolved between the two regulatory entities, I guess. So there are complications along those lines also. Compatibility is crucial to a contractor. You will be creating, if you pass this, will be creating additional administrative work for the contractors.
Thank you, Steve. Any questions? Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, you make a statement that it's going to create a lot more administrative work for the contractor, and I think the bill with the Dash 1 amendment clearly puts the burden on the contracting agency to identify the correct wages for the classification. So I'm wondering what other administrative burden this bill would place on the contractor.
Representative Holby, or Chair Brown, Representative Holby, this is Steve Schneider again. I'm not that familiar with the Dash 1. I haven't seen that amendment. But from what you have just said, I would say the overtime still plays into that. Federal law doesn't require daily overtime. And actually, if we could get rid of just the daily weighted average requirements that BOLI has been enforcing, would help tremendously, which I don't even know we need a statute change to do that. But it would help a lot, along with what Representative Schaffler had suggested, to help getting software out there that we can use.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have one more question for John. I'm wondering, you'd mentioned you're with the Oregon Electrical Contractors. Do your contractors often come into prevailing wage work where they are subject to both federal Davis-Bacon and state BOLI financing at the same time?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, in all honesty, not a ton, not a lot. It does happen. They are out there on occasion. A good example is escaping me right at the moment, but it once in a while.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Could I have Greg Miller, please?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Miller. I'm here on behalf of the Associated General Contractors Oregon Columbia Chapter. Here to raise a concern that AGC has with House Bill 2710 in that the determination of the wage, as Mr. Ocheld from the counties indicated, needs to be done by the contracting agency. To print the state and the federal would just add to the confusion in the bid documents, and that the contractor would still be on the hook to determine the proper rate of wage. And for simplicity purposes and for the clarity of the law, we feel that if the federal or the state was printed, and then the contracting agency would be responsible for printing the correct wages, would be appropriate for contracting.
Have you seen the Dash 1 amendment?
Yeah, and the Dash 1s, I believe, as I read them, state that the state wage and the federal wage books would be printed with any contract documents, and there's still the confusion between the federal and state wages. And for clarity, if either one or the other was printed with the bid documents, would be appropriate for the contracting agents or contracting firms.
Okay. Any questions are great.
The comment, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I appreciate the AGC's concern, and I think that the Dash 1 amendment addresses that concern to make sure that the contracting agency is supplying that information to the contractor. That's the intent, and we'll make sure it gets there if it doesn't.
Yep.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 2710? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2710 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3382 and 3383. Janet, can you give us a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3382 would direct the Commissioner of Labor to determine which prevailing wage rates apply to a public works contract that is exempt from competitive bidding. And House Bill 3383 would apply the requirements to pay the state prevailing wage to workers who manufacture or fabricate non-standard items that are made to order for a public works project, regardless of where the fabrication is done. And they'd be currently applied only if the fabrication is done on site, is my understanding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Schaffer, didn't you?
No, I'm just going to let the nice people
go with the flow, huh?
Yep.
Could I have Jared Broadfoot, please, and Bob Shiprack, please? Jared?
Just making rat faces. Which one did you want to do first?
Let me do 3382.
Okay. I'm Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I had this bill introduced, and I want you to just ignore all the bold print and look at the relating clause. It's strictly a placeholder. I'll tell you what prompted me to bring this forward, and I'll try and explain what an exempt public works contract is. Generally speaking, in most public works contract, we do things under what's known as design, bid, build. You get plans, you take it out to bid, and the contractor builds it. Standard procedure. As public contracting has evolved, however, we went into new types of contracting methods that don't follow the design, build, bid, build method. We have what's known as CMGC, which stands for construction manager / general contractor. We also have a new thing out now called design, build. These types of contracting do not fall under ORS 279, which is the public works section of the ORSs that explain how you advertise and bid and put projects out. The issue involved in House Bill 3382 is an attempt, once again, to clarify what the rules and the laws are going to be for when, in this case, when prevailing wages would apply to the project. When does the contractor know what the rates are going to be? Under design, bid, build, our traditional method, everybody knows that time because the statute requires the public contracting agency to publicly advertise for any project. So every day I subscribe to the Daily Journal of Commerce. You open it up and there's these lists of all these projects that are being advertised to the public. The law there says that the day you advertise the project for bids is when the rates will apply. It's a bright line standard. All you got to do when you want to know what rates apply, just ask when was it advertised and you can get it out of the paper. That doesn't happen with these other alternative bidding methods. In 96, 97, Hoffman Construction Company called me up. They're Oregon's largest general contractor, building contractor. They had a prison, jail, actually, that they were going to build up in the Dalles. And it was a consortium of three counties, and they were selected to be the general contractor under a CMGC project. It was not advertised and bid and all that. One of the counties dropped out. It took about 2 years for them to get the funding put together, and they called me. They said, well, we're looking here at two-year-old prevailing wage rates to bid this jail, and we don't want to do that because they're so outdated, and we wouldn't get good bids, and the contractors that we want to bid on it. So we went to Jack Roberts, the Commissioner of Labor at the time, described the situation. Again, these bidding practices are new. The legislature just hasn't dealt with this issue. So we came up with a policy that was written in the Boley policy book and a book of statutes. And what the policy said is that the prevailing wages would be established for these exempt types of projects when you advertise the first bid package. So in this, what typically happens, the CMGC or design bid build contractor gets the job. They immediately start putting out bid packages. The first one's always the dirt work and utilities, obviously. And then these packages come out. They are publicly advertised, and we can go back to that same bright line standard. That worked well for a long time. About 8 years, I guess, 7-8 years. Then last summer, there was an issue that arose in a school district. It was a CMGC project. They did not use the policy that Boley had described. I don't know the details, and I don't even want to go into a wage claim. It's not the time or place. And there was a wage claim filed, and there was a hoo-ha over the fact that the wages were not correct. Our prevailing wage advisory committee that I sit on wrestled with this issue. At the beginning, some people thought that the rate should be established at the time there's a request for proposals. There's not even a project at that time. There's not even a drawing. It was just somebody's idea. And they're asking for contractors to solicit some interest. Then it was talked about perhaps doing this when there is a guaranteed maximum price contract signed. That's a little better. I'll cut to the chase, Mr. Chair. I'm asking this committee and the legislature to give us some direction on when these rates should be established, because there is nothing today. The policy was abandoned by Boley. They were going to do some rulemaking. I asked that maybe we should bring this to the legislature. I would hope that we could go back to the old policy, which simply was when you advertise for your first bid package, that's when the rate's established. Everybody knows it. It's in the paper. We're used to that kind of system. So I'll stop.
Representative Esquivel.
So what you're saying is when municipalities or governmental entities do an RFP, request for proposal, uh-huh, at the time you have an established rate by the entity, or who establishes that rate?
There is no rate at that, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I know. I know what you're saying, but I mean, it's kind of like, how is this actually working today?
The requests for proposals are simply that they would evaluate the various general contractors that apply for this. Basically, at that stage of the game, it's more value engineering, and the intent is to work with the architect and engineer to try and get a building that the agency can afford. I support it, and that you've got a good general contractor there that can tell you what the constructability issues and some of the cost things are. Wages at that point are really moot.
Okay, so what you're saying is once the RFP process is done, then you come back in when you bid the contract. And
correct.
And you have a certain wage, but I mean,
once,
what you're asking is who's putting this wage out?
Once the public contracting agency has selected a general contractor, CMGC,
right,
signed a contract, that contractor then puts the first bid package out on the street, they publicly advertise it, that day the rate is established.
Okay, got it.
Yes.
That's the trigger.
Everyone knows it.
Thank you. Let's see, Jared, you're here to testify on 3383. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jared Broadfoot here today representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association in support of House Bill 3383. I want to thank the chair for hearing the bill and thank Representative Schaffler for chief sponsoring the bill. Let me just explain the issue to you. If we've got a public works project, for instance, say one of our sheet metal contractors who prefabricates ductwork that's non-standard ducting work for a public works building and a project. Currently, contractors are able not to pay those folks prevailing wage. They're doing work that's specifically for a public works project that's a prevailed job, but they're able to sidestep it and not pay those folks prevailing wage because they're prefabbing the materials, the non-standard materials, off-site. And let me make it clear what we're not after here. We're not after suppliers having to pay prevailing wage. What our target is non-standard items that are prefabricated specifically for that job but require to be prefabbed off-site, or because of the way the law is written now, are prefabbed off-site on purpose to sidestep prevailing wage law. So it's pretty simple what we're after. It affects more the sheet metal contractors than anyone else, but this would affect plumbers and then even Washington. We're reviewing Washington's law right now and their rules, and they've got a pretty lengthy list of what is considered non-standard prefabbed items that would require prevailing wage to be paid under their current rules and what's not. And I would say 75 or 80% of that list is not required. There's a small portion that is, but that's what we're doing right now, and we would request that we be able to work with Representative Schaffler and the rest of the folks that showed up here today with pitchforks and sticks that were on fire to march up here and hope they're not sitting directly behind me right now. But nothing like a public hearing to get those folks excited. But we would like to work with those folks to make sure that we can clearly define what it is the non-standard items are. I know the language in the bill currently is fairly broad, and it's intended to be that way so we could get the discussion, actually move something forward that we can work with, because it's absolutely not fair for a contractor who's working on a public works job who is required because their equipment's at their shop that are prefabbing non-standard items for that job to be able to be cut out of the prevailed wage rate. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I wish we could go retroactive back to about September of 88, because I spent 2.5 years building off-site, non-standard, precast concrete structures. And when I went out to work on the job site, I got prevailing wage, but not in the yard. I didn't. I'm not trying to poke anybody on the other side of the building in the eye. It was a great job. I liked working there. I learned a lot. It helped me a lot when I went up started my own business. But it would have applied directly to this laborer and a whole bunch of my old pals. So I can sympathize.
Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I have, let's see... John O'Shell, Christy Monson, and this time Greg Miller.
Here.
Christine's gone.
Christy's gone, yeah.
Threw in the towel.
She already said they would.
Okay. Okay. John, why don't we start with you?
John O'Shell, Association of Oregon Counties, to 3382. Basically, since it's a placeholder for something we're going to see later, I don't know.
That'll work.
Regarding House Bill 3383, once again, as to the policy issue, Oregon counties is neutral. What we need is clarity. It is a wide-ranging, the one I was thinking back of the room was the same one that Representative Schaffler. We get to a whole bunch of precast concrete work and road work. Traffic signals, almost all of that stuff. Possibly the phrase shop drawings maybe needs to come into this, because basically there's a lot of stuff in contract work where a requirement of the construction is that the contractor submit shop drawings. Gives you an indicator that it's being built off-site. What you really have in effect is a bunch of people we're now calling suppliers, who in effect we maybe need to be calling subcontractors, I'm not sure where the answer is on this. Once again, our goal would be just to get clarity so we know for sure who we need to be receiving certified payrolls from.
Thank you, John. Greg.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Greg Miller. I'm with the Associated General Contractors, Oregon Columbia Chapter. If I could speak first to House Bill 3382, Mr. Shipwreck indicated the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee vetted this issue at length through the interim, and we believe that they found compromise, and Boley will take care of this issue via rule. So we see this bill as unnecessary legislation. So that's our position on this bill. As to 3383, again, what Mr. Oshild explained, there are some uncertainties in the bill as to what material will be covered, who will be covered off-site, and another issue is out-of-state work. How will out-of-state work be covered? We have a lot of members that work in the state of Washington. It's just that administration right now, there's a lot of questions that we have that need to be answered.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. Could I have Jeff Dean and Steve Snyder and John Kelly on again, please?
No, all this is going to work. Just bring
that in. Good morning again.
Good morning.
John Killen for the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. 3382, looking forward to seeing amendments or discussion. Be happy to be part of that. 3383, we appreciate the sentiment and the intent. We're not opposed to it per se. The current bill is very wide-ranging, as has already been said. If we got down to the intent, we'd be happy to talk about it at that point.
Thank you.
Jeff Dean, Director of Government Affairs for Associated Builders and Contractors. I'll speak simply to 3383. We are in opposition to this bill. We are concerned, for one thing, about the ambiguity. And the definitions, there are no definitions in the bill. We don't know how far this would take it. And we also have concerns regarding the simple policy of this and what direction it would take Oregon's prevailing wage laws. We know there's already some bills in the legislature right now that would seek to apply prevailing wage on private projects, and we think this is another step in that process, similar philosophy, so we're opposed.
Thank you. Steve.
Steve Schneider, Schneider Equipment and Drilling. Also oppose this bill. I can see quite a few complications as it's written. It is very broad-based. We do a lot of pumps and water treatment plants and related type situations. A good portion of the components that go into that are custom built, whether it be pumps, electrical panels, clarifier components, whatever. What we'd be doing with this bill, as I see it, is now we're requiring manufacturers to comply with prevailing wage. The enforcement becomes not just a statewide issue. It's now a not just nationwide issue, becomes a multinational issue. We have components coming from outside the United States that go into these that are custom built. The cost just would certainly go up. We're going to have some suppliers that just say, I refuse to quote. I'm not going to comply with this, as we've addressed even on the threshold bill. Along the similar lines, how do we survey? Boley's survey that is required to establish these rates now must expand around the world. I think this is asking for the impossible. I ask you to oppose this.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up, Mr. Schneider. That's not what the intent of this bill is, and I'm confident it will be narrowed down to where it could be manageable. So that is certainly not the intent of the sponsor of this bill or the good people that requested its drafting. So I just wanted to make that clear for the record. So when you go home tonight, you don't got to worry about all those little widgets in your wells that you're, and I'm grateful you're out there putting them in. And if I had my way, you'd be putting a lot more in. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony this morning. Julie Brandes. Oh. We set the stage so you'd be there all by yourself.
Yeah, there you go. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis. We are here today. I'm representing Associated Oregon History here and in opposition to House Bill 3383. With some new committee members, I think just a part of AOI history is we've always opposed expansion of prevailing wage. We've done that in a variety of ways with a variety of pieces of legislation. I think the proponent, the other opponents who have testified before me have done a very good job of explaining why we might oppose a legislation like this. For example, I think that the lacking the definition of non-standard items is very concerning to us, especially that this would be left up somehow to rule. And again, although we try to work very closely with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, quite often we're at odds with them, and so that is another concern that we would have. So out-of-state, out-of-country suppliers, out-of-state suppliers, all of those things come into play when looking at how we comply with this legislation.
Thank you, Julie. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 3382 or 83? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on that in committee. Janet, do we have anything else?
No, Mr. Chair. It may behoove people to be on time for Wednesday's meeting because we have some work sessions right at the beginning that it would be nice to get out of the way before a minimum wage hearing.
Can we get that message to Representative Kitts?
Yeah.
Thank you, Janet. Nothing else? We are adjourned.